I raised one of them, looking at it critically. The more I learn, the less I can do.
Does it scare you?
I lowered my hand, thinking about his question for a long moment before I said, Yes. What if it never comes back? What if I trade being actually useful for knowing all the things I could do, if only I hadn't put the fire away? But it makes me hopeful, too. I didn't always set things on fire without meaning to. I used to be pretty much normal. I could probably adapt to being normal again. I'd spend less on burn cream anyway. Sam bumped my shoulder with his.
This is a bad time to start lying to me.
Come again?
I've met you. You've never been normal, Melody.
I wrinkled my nose at him. He'd been given strict instructions to use my alias throughout the day, and he hadn't slipped once. Dating a cryptid meant dating someone who knew what it was to keep a secret or pay the price. But he kept saying my name like it was some sort of complicated joke he was hoping I'd understand. Sam grinned at me.
So, this is what you do now?
He asked, changing the topic.
You wander around somebody else's playground, keeping kids from trying to eat the decor?
Most of the time I'm in Fairyland, not Candyland, I said. But yes, I spend my days trying to keep kids from tearing the park apart and making sure all of these people will think of us before they think of anyone else when it's time to plan their next family vacation.
Do you like it?
I paused. Finally, I said, That's sort of a hard question for me. I'm pretty good at my job. I don't mind the rules. Management does their best to be fair, and I like being allowed to run around the park when I'm not on duty. Gives me something to focus on. I appreciate that. There are a lot of moving pieces in Lowryland. I could work here for 20 years and not know everything. Sam looked perplexed.
Do you want to work here for 20 years?
Oh, hell no. I didn't have to think about that answer. I want to go home. I miss my family. I want to know what's going on. Exile may be fun for a little while, but as a long-term plan, it's terrible. I have no concept of where we stand with... I dropped my voice. You know. Was I being paranoid, thinking that a member of the Covenant of St. George might have decided to bring their children for a pleasant vacation in Lowryland? Yes. But, much like Fern hadn't been able to reveal herself to the dragons without fear of causing trouble, I couldn't run the risk of the Covenant hearing me. It was funny. We were in a cathedral built to honor and uplift fairy tales. Everything about this place was a story, carefully crafted and orchestrated to instill a sense of awe and wonder in the guests around us. I could have stood up and started explaining, loudly, how a ghost had been my primary babysitter since I was born, how she had sung me doo-wop songs in my cradle, and organized my family's colony of talking mice into backup choruses, and no one would have batted an eye. Lowryland was where you went to be a little left of the norm. That didn't change the fact that if I used proper names, called Mary a crossroads ghost, or called the mice an Aeslin colony, I'd be running the risk of attracting the wrong kind of attention. Stories are universal. Details, though. Details can get you killed.
When do you think it'll be safe to go home?
I don't know. I sighed. It's not like I have an exit strategy here. I'm sort of hoping that once I know enough about my magic, I'll be able to shield myself from anyone who comes looking. I could go home if I just knew I wouldn't be followed.
Can't marry.
No. The word came out sharper than I meant for it to. I stood, picking up our empty plates, and said, There are some serious limits to what Mary can and can't do for me. Actually, teaching me is off the table. So is doing that sort of a favor. I'd need to make a bargain for that. Sam pulled a face. Interesting. I never had asked whether the Fury had a tradition of crossroads bargains. Looks like they did.
No, he said. Let's not do that.
Agreed, let's not. I started down the path, which had been stylized to look like it was made from frosting, flanked by springy gumdrops. Too much time in Candyland could make me feel like I needed to eat the entire world. We can't cut through Fairyland, so it's back to the hub from here, and then on to the deep down. I think you'll like the mermaids, and the Drowned World Coaster is supposed to be one of the better ones in Florida. It's definitely the only one with actual sharks as part of the ride environment. I chattered as I walked, trusting Sam to follow me. We were doing this for him, after all. I liked the park, but with Fairyland off the menu, I would already have been in the deep down, hanging out with the Phantom Pirates and eating endless buckets of chicken at Mother Carey's seaside barbecue. Sam was the one who wanted to see absolutely everything that Lowryland had to offer, and I was merely his willing guide. I was so focused on telling him about our next steps that I didn't hear the cracking until it turned into a splintering roar, followed by the sound of children screaming. I whipped around. The top of one of the taffy flower trees, a plastic and steel rebar brainchild of Lowry's engineering division, had snapped off and was plummeting toward a pair of kids holding plates of gingerbread. They couldn't have been more than 7, and they were watching the tree fall with the dull-eyed resignation of the walking dead. They knew this was how they ended. A brown blur slammed into them from the side, knocking them out of the way before the tree could crush them. Their screams turned into the open-throated sobs of frightened children everywhere. Sam. Because it could only have been Sam. No one and nothing else moved that fast. Didn't stop or slow down. He kept moving, into the shadows of the artificial forest. By the time he popped out again, I knew what he was about to do. And I braced. Dropping our plates into the trash bin, I raised my arms, like I was preparing to be caught on the trapeze. He grabbed onto me with surprising delicacy, wrapping one arm around my torso and his tail around my waist, and I was borne up, away from the ground, into the distant spires of Lowry's closed and smoke-singed fairyland. Chapter 16. One of these days, something is going to go right, but probably not today. Jane Harrington Price. Lowryland. About to have a very unpleasant afternoon. Sam didn't stop running until we were well away from the crowds and standing under the awning of the Midsummer Night's Scream waiting area. The small bus stop-like structure was intended for use by families of riders, people whose health wasn't good enough or height wasn't great enough to endure the multiple drops and inversions. He let go of me, stepping away. "Cameras?" he asked, huffing and puffing all the while. "What?" I blinked at him for a moment before I realized, with horror and dawning dismay, that he hadn't shifted back to his faux human form. He was still Simeon, clearly Fury. "Sam, change back. Are there cameras here?" He leaned forward, putting his hands on his knees. It wasn't nearly as pronounced a lean as it would have been for a human his height and build. Still struggling to get his breath back, he asked, "Is anyone recording this?" Something was wrong. I looked frantically around, comparing the angles of the roof to the known locations of the surrounding cameras before I said, "No, we passed at least 6 getting here, but there aren't any cameras focused on this spot."
"Good."
He straightened up, wheezing a little, and said,
"Get me out of here."
"Can you?"
"No."
The word was simple, direct, and changed everything. I looked around again, mentally comparing what I knew of the park layout to what I knew of the camera array. Fern and I had spent a cheerful week learning the location of most of the hidden cameras before we'd started skating in the park, using that as a guide to where she could and couldn't play games with density. Like all major theme parks, Lowryland is incredibly focused on guest safety and security, and figured out long ago that cameras were both cheaper and less distracting than security patrols. If you're in a public area, or more importantly, on a ride, someone is watching. It keeps graffiti and shoplifting under control, and prevents people from doing things they shouldn't while the rides are in motion. But there are blind spots. Even the most comprehensive camera array in the world can't be everywhere. Most of the rides had cameras on the areas people were able to access easily, preventing kids from slipping under barricades and falling into the artificial deep-sea vents in the deep down, or climbing the conveyor system in Metropolis. But that was as far as they went. Putting cameras on an entire outdoor ride environment didn't make fiscal sense, and there was no way a guest could get to, say, the back of the Midsummer Night's Scream without tripping a few of the exterior cameras. Unless they could go straight up to avoid the ground cameras entirely, that was. "All right," I said. "Can you pick me up again?" Sam didn't say anything, only nodded. "Okay. See that tree? I pointed. Look at the fourth branch up. That's the only camera aimed at the waiting area. It may not even be on since the zone is closed, but we don't want to count on that. I need you to jump from here to the branch right below the camera. That should take us through the blind spot. Can you do that?
I hope so.
Sam sounded uncertain. That was enough to give me pause, but when he held out his hand, I still took it, letting him gather me in something that was between a bridal carry and the beginnings of a fastball special. He took a step backward, looking assessingly at the branch, and then he leaped. Nothing human could have made that jump. Humans can be strong, swift, and athletic, but we don't have the raw muscle power of our simian cousins. Sam had the strength. Even then, he might not have been able to hit the mark if he hadn't spent his entire life training for the trapeze. Everything we are in any given moment is the sum of our experiences and choices up until then. And as we flew through the air, with me clinging to his arms, I was temporarily glad that the fire in my fingers had fled. My nerves were so frayed that I would definitely have burned him otherwise. He landed on the branch so lightly it barely rocked. I pressed a finger to my lips, signaling him to silence, and pointed to a point on the roller coaster's environmental shell that was just outside the range of what guests were assumed to be able to reach. Florida's weather, while generally warm, is unpredictable enough that building fully outdoor roller coasters is a gamble. Sure, they look impressive, but there's always a chance a storm will roll in and shut them down during the busy season, and any exposed track is likely to require triple the maintenance. The Midsummer Night's Scream was constructed almost entirely inside a plastic and fiberglass mountain, covered with real soil and real plants, including a blackberry tangle wide and wild enough that it had to be cut back weekly to keep it from getting out of control. The coaster train only emerged into the open air 3 times during the ride, twice in plain sight at the viewing area. That was enough to keep families mollified, and the controlled ride environment inside the mountain made it substantially easier to control the overall experience. Everyone walked away happy. Right now, the mountain was serving a different purpose. Cover. Sam leaped from the branch to the point I'd indicated, and then again, when I pointed for the second time, into the heart of the blackberry snarl. The landscaping team had a private entrance there, right where the vines grew thickest. They used it for pruning the bushes without affecting what guests saw, since management wanted the Midsummer Night's Scream to look like an untouchable fairy wilderness. That was working in our favor. If there was one place in Lowryland where I knew there wasn't a camera, it was here. Sam put me down as soon as we landed, huffing and puffing again. I took a step backward to give him room, stopping when the briars behind me poked my shoulder. His tail curled and uncurled around his ankle, betraying his anxiety more clearly than anything else about him. "What's wrong?" I demanded.
"I don't know."
He gave me a half-panicked look.
"I keep trying to go back, and I can't. It's like that part of my brain isn't working anymore."
"Okay, we can deal with this. We're out of range of the cameras.
How are we going to deal with this?"
he snapped.
"You can't even start a fire."
I gave him a hurt look. "Sam, I'm trying to help. Please don't yell at me."
"Sorry, I'm sorry. I just don't know what to do."
He rubbed his face with one hand.
"This has never happened to me before."
"Getting stuck?" He nodded, face still covered. I realized that he hadn't looked directly at me since we'd landed here, not even when he was snapping at me. Stepping slightly forward, we were in close quarters, but he'd still managed to put distance between us when he put me down. I gently gripped his wrist and tugged. He was stronger than I was. He could have resisted me. He didn't. Instead, he let me lower his arm, revealing the anxious, almost trapped expression in his eyes. "Hey." I didn't let go of his wrist. "We'll fix this."
"What if we don't? What if this is something that happens to Fury eventually and nobody told me because my dad is off in China somewhere and my mom didn't leave a forwarding address or instructions on where to find him? What if I was supposed to start hiding from people months ago to keep from being surrounded when the switch snapped?"
"Okay, breathe. If Fury got stuck in one shape or another, it would have been in my family's records, and it's not." Grandpa Thomas wrote about visiting a whole neighborhood of Fury in Hong Kong before he settled in Michigan. And he didn't say, but the grandparents never changed shapes, so I guess they couldn't. And that's not the sort of detail he would have missed. This isn't just something that happens.
Then why is it happening now?
I don't know, I said. Why can't I set things on fire? Something's wrong, but Sam, if you were going to get stuck, this is the best place in the world to do it. All we have to do is avoid security. Any guests who see you will think you're with one of the shows. Sam didn't look impressed by my logic. He twisted his wrist out of my grip, and I let him go, although not without regret. His body language was hunched, closed down, and the anxiety in his eyes was quickly mounting toward a full-blown panic. I had never regretted the difference in our species more. Maybe if I'd been a Fury, I would have known what to do. But the little, difficult-to-articulate touches were that would let me unlock the door to his fear and let the shadows out. Or maybe I did know. I'd been scared for a long time about someone discovering the fire in my fingers, alternately wishing it away and wishing it on everyone else, wishing for an X-Men world where we'd all have weird powers and no one would be different. And knowing that it wouldn't have changed a damn thing, because we already do live in an X-Men world. Artie is an empath with pheromones that make him endlessly attractive to anyone who likes guys and isn't a close relative, which is why he spends all his time locked in his basement. Elsie is a persuasive telepath, and her blood makes people horny and possessive. Sarah is Sarah. Add in the dead aunts and the dimension-hopping grandmother, and we're already a comic book, and it's never made anything easier. Not for a second. Sam. I reached for him again, this time resting the back of my fingers against his cheek. He closed his eyes, leaning into the touch. Thankfully. I don't know what I would have done if he'd recoiled from me. I'll figure it out. And if you can't, then we'll figure out a way to get you safely back to Indiana, and I'll come for you as soon as I can. His eyes snapped open. What? He looked so startled that I actually laughed, which could have been the exact wrong thing to do. I hesitated. He didn't pull away. I risked a smile. What? You think you can get rid of me just because you stopped shaving? Please. My cousin Artie is one of my best friends, and he hasn't seen the sky without coercion in years. Literally, years. If you took him outside at noon and didn't slather him in sunscreen, he'd probably burst into flames. I kept smiling. I've never asked you to stay human before I would kiss you, have I? It'll mean spending a little more time apart, but whatever. It's not like we don't know how to do that. I think it's most of what we've done so far. Relief flooded over Sam's face. His tail wrapped tight around my waist and he pulled me toward him, virtually yanking me into an embrace. I didn't resist, not then, and not when he started kissing me, hands against the sides of my face. Tail tightening as if to make absolutely sure that I knew better than to try going anywhere. When he finally pulled back, he rested his forehead against mine and said, "Thank you." "It's okay," I assured him. "We've been through enough. I'm not letting you go over something this small."
"Called this small?"
He held up one long-fingered hand.
"This is all of me."
"That's what I said." I grinned briefly before sobering. "But it's all of you that we need to get out of here. Lowryland doesn't allow adults to wear costumes." Sam snorted.
"Good thing I'm not wearing a costume, huh?"
"Yeah." I turned to look thoughtfully at the maintenance door. "I have an idea. Ever seen Alien?" Sam blinked. "It's technically a violation of, oh, several dozen Lowry Entertainment Inc. rules to take non-employees into the tunnels under the park. Punishable by immediate termination, fines, black mark on your record, yada yada, everything is awful. But, at the end of the day, they'd have to catch me before they could do anything about it. The tunnels leading to Fairyland were largely deserted, since maintenance still happened at night, even when there were closures on park property. The process of restoring the street to its pre-accident condition would be swift, efficient, and most of all, unseen. Anything that could break the illusion that Lowryland was a magical kingdom where nothing ever went wrong would be concealed from the eyes of our paying guests, because without them, the park might as well burn. I inched in first, looking around to be sure I was alone, before beckoning for Sam to join me. The sound of the door closing behind him seemed impossibly loud. I winced, waiting for footsteps to come running in our direction. When they didn't, I relaxed marginally and pointed upward, indicating the supports and pipes running across the ceiling. "Most of those should hold your weight," I whispered. "If something seems unstable, move on to the next one and keep moving. As long as you don't fall."
"You'd make a hot space marine,"
he said, and kissed my cheek before jumping nimbly up to the ceiling, catching hold of the pipes with hands, feet, and tail. He had to pull himself into what was virtually a crawl, rather than dangling with bent knees, but once he was done, he was far enough up that no one was going to see him by mistake. I hoped. I blew him a kiss and started walking. This wasn't a tunnel section I was familiar with, but the people in charge of Lowryland's subterranean layout learned long ago that getting employees lost wasn't good for anybody. All the thoroughfares are constructed along as simple and straightforward a pattern as possible. And while there aren't any maps, there are little architectural quirks that can be used for orientation if necessary. As for why there are no maps, well, if a guest did somehow manage to get into the tunnels, we wanted them to get lost. Not permanently open a missing persons case levels of lost, but lost enough that they'd think twice before going through any more forbidden doors. We got one or two kids in the tunnels every season, usually people who'd read about them online and couldn't wait to see the secret side of Lowryland for themselves. They forgot that some things are secret for a reason. Sam moved like a shadow on the ceiling above me, making my joking alien comparison a little more unnerving. Every time I caught a glimpse of his tail from the corner of my eye, I would stiffen momentarily, until I remembered it was my boyfriend and not a murderous xenomorph. "Definitely a Halloween costume to keep in mind," I muttered. "There isn't much cell signal in the tunnels. Phone calls were right out, but text messages could generally get through." I pulled out my phone as I walked, keying in Celia's number, before texting a quick request for her to come and pick up me, plus a guest, and to bring something with a hood. Hopefully she'd be curious enough to actually show up, and compassionate enough to bring what I'd asked for. If she wasn't there when we emerged, we'd figure something out. Figuring something out is sort of what it means to be a Price. The unfamiliar tunnels gave way to more familiar ones, and I kept walking. The sound of conversation from up ahead drifted back to greet us. I tensed and kept going as a Metropolis food service crew passed, some of them nodding genially in my direction. I didn't recognize any of their faces. That didn't matter. If I was down here, moving with a purpose, I was a cast member, and if I was a cast member, I was family. We didn't all like each other. We still had to stand together against the endless tide of tourists and demands. Once they were out of sight behind me, I glanced at the ceiling and flashed Sam a thumbs up. He returned the gesture, looking relieved. Maybe this was going to work after all.
"Well, well, well," said a voice. "If it isn't Princess Melody, slumming, Your Highness."
"Hello, Robin," I said, turning to face her. Don't let her look up, I thought. Distract her so she doesn't look up. What are you doing down here?
"Unlike some people, I still have to work for a living," she snapped.
She was in the paper doll primary colors of chapter and verse, the exaggerated stitches on the sleeves dyed yellow, which meant she was working somewhere near Aspen and Elm. She wasn't one of their handmaids. That was a much more flattering costume. That mattered. She knew I lived with Fern, and I wouldn't have wanted to wind her up before sending her off to spend a shift with my roommate.
"Oh, right. You weren't in Fairyland yesterday, since they stopped scheduling us together after we reached the mutually assured destruction stage. I got the day off because I wound up covered in blood after I ran to help our guests. Helping people. That's not something you'd know much about, is it?"
I offered her a sugary smile.
"I earned this break. Sorry you didn't. Seems like you just happened to earn everything good and I don't earn anything."
Robin took a step forward,
back suddenly straight, shoulders suddenly hunched. She wasn't taller than I am. Few women are. But she was a pretty sizable girl. She could do some damage if she decided she wanted to. On some level, I wanted her to try. I hadn't been in a proper brawl in months. At least when I'd been with the Covenant, and then with the Carnival, I'd been able to keep myself in shape, sparring with people and bouncing off the walls. Since coming to Lakeland, I'd been taking my training where I could find it. And where I could find it came with a shameful lack of punching things. Plus, I knew I could put her down in under a minute if I had to. That was the problem. No matter what the movies say, knocking someone unconscious is a dangerous game. I'd either need to crack her skull without breaking it or cut off the blood supply to her brain without doing permanent damage. One slip and I could kill her. Not something to do lightly and not something to do when I was trying to sneak Sam out unseen. I couldn't forget the fact that he was clinging to the ceiling above me and would get involved if he felt he needed to. Quick and clean. That was the plan. Maybe if you were nicer to people, people would be nicer to you, I said. Who are you to talk? You don't have any friends except for the little blonde bubble girl. What, did you steal her from a cult somewhere? Don't talk about Fern like that. I'll talk about Fern any way I damn well please, and you won't stop me. Robin peeled her lips back in a sneer. She's a freak, and so are you. Good, honest people shouldn't have to look at your kind when we're in a place like Lowry Land. Pretty sure Michael Lowry would say we were the ones he built it for, the ones who needed it, and not the ones who wanted it. Pretty sure Michael Lowry's dead, said Robin, and swung for my face. By the time her fist was there, I wasn't anymore. She overswung and stopped, looking puzzled. Come back here, she snapped. What, so you can hit me? I don't think so. She swung again. I dodged again. It would have been funny if she hadn't been getting so much more progressively frustrated. It was like sparring with one of my parents back when I'd been an 8-year-old ball of rage and ambitions, with reflexes that couldn't quite keep up with what I wanted them to do. They'd always given me a few easy ones to evade before they started really trying to hit me, letting me find my rhythm, letting me feel like I could win. Only here, there was no letting about what Robin was doing. She was pulling out her best moves and had no idea why I was evading them with such ease. There were tears in her eyes when she made her third swing, again missing me by a country mile. That seemed to be the last straw. She stopped attacking and stood there, glaring daggers at me. What are you? She demanded. A former cheerleader, I replied. We learned to dodge. Robin shook her head in disgust. You're never going to be a Lowry girl. Never. You'll always be an outsider, and we're never gonna let you in. You don't need to, I said. I've got friends, and I've got plans. And right now, I've got places to be. Leave me alone, all right? That's all I've ever wanted you to do. Robin sniffed, and for a moment I thought she was going to do something else, apologize, maybe, or attack me again. It could have gone either way, and either way had the potential to be interesting, because either way had the potential to change things. Instead, she sneered, I have a shift, and walked on down the tunnel, heading for chapter and verse. I waited until her footsteps had faded before glancing up. Sam wasn't there. Panic had time to grip my chest, acid bright and electric, before he stuck his head out of one of the electrical vents on the ceiling and said in a loud whisper, You could fit a whole squad of Boy Scouts in this thing. Sam, what? If you put her on the floor, I didn't want her to look up and think she was hallucinating the giant monkey. He pulled himself out of the vent, dangling by his arms for a moment before he got feet and tail wrapped back around their respective grips and had recovered his previous flat position. Besides, it let me rest my arms for a second. Are all your co-workers that sweet? She's the sweetest, I said. I started walking again. Above me, Sam matched my stride, moving with an inhumanly fluid ease. I keep to myself, and I don't play social games. For some people, that makes me weird, and possibly a threat. As long as they don't start putting poison in my bag lunches, I don't care.
You don't like people much.
Neither do you. Sam laughed darkly.
I guess that's why we like each other.
I smiled, keeping my head down, and kept walking. We reached the narrow, near-abandoned tunnel that Fern had shown me after the accident. After we had turned the first corner, out of view of the main passageway, and well clear of anyone else looking to get to work, I glanced up. You can come down now, I said. It should be safe.
Thank God.
Sam dropped to floor level, landing in a crouch before straightening up and beginning to massage his hands.
I thought I was going to get a cramp.
On the plus side, your position on this season of American Ninja Gladiator is pretty much secure.
You don't think they'll call the tail cheating?
They may want you to tie a weight to it or something.
Fun for the whole family.
He looked at me sidelong and smiled almost shyly.
Thanks again for helping me out of here.
That's what I'm here for. I could feel my cheeks getting red. People being consistently glad to see me was a weird enough experience these days to be a little weird and embarrassing. I was going to have to get used to it if Sam was going to stick around, and I wanted Sam to stick around. I wanted it more than I would ever have been able to admit to myself 2 days ago.
Not just that,
he said, wrapping his tail loosely around my left wrist while he kept rubbing his hands. I flashed him a smile. We walked on. At the end of the tunnel, I gently unwound his tail from my wrist and turned to face him. Okay, this is what happens next, I said. I'm going to go out and see if my friend Celia brought you that hoodie. If she's there, and if she did, we're in the clear. If either of those things is missing, we'll figure it out. Either way, we're not on Lowry property anymore, so things should get a little easier.
Who's Celia?
Sam asked warily. Crap, that was the step I'd forgotten. She's someone I skate with back at home, I said. She's trustworthy, I promise. He relaxed.
So, she's not human, but you don't want to say she's not human because that's her business, not mine, he said. Cool. I mean, you kind of have to tell her right now, me being furry and everything, but you don't gotta tell me until she's comfortable with it.
Exactly. I kissed his cheek, quick and light, and opened the door, letting the summer sunlight come slanting in. It was brighter than I expected, almost blinding after the dimness of the tunnels. I squinted. There was an avocado-colored muscle car parked at the curb. Silently thanking every deity I could come up with for Celia's lack of a social life, I trotted over the dusty ground between me and the street. The window was already down when I reached the car. I leaned inside. Celia gave me a look split evenly between worry and curiosity.
Everything okay? She asked.
Did you bring the hoodie? I asked. She nodded before leaning into the back seat and pulling out a cloak, an actual cloak, the sort of thing Alex used to wear when he was going off to war with his SCA buddies. Because pretending to go to war on the weekend was absolutely a fun thing when there was always the chance of the Covenant of St. George bringing the war home to us. Yes, fun and not weird and a little questionable.
Really? We have some pre-game shtick involving Merlin and the tree, and it's a long story, but will this work?
She thrust the cloak at me. I took it. It was easily 6 feet long, and while the fabric was heavy enough to cause heat stroke if worn for long in this climate, Sam wasn't going to be wearing it for long. It's perfect, I said. I'll be right back. I turned then, running back across the ground to the tunnel opening. The door was cracked slightly, and I could see Sam peeping out. When I was close enough, I grabbed it, hauled it open, and thrust the cloak at him. Put this on, I commanded.
What the- Whoa. You have friends with wizard cloaks in their closets, just like, lying around?
He looked at it for a moment, bewildered, before swinging it around himself and fastening the clasp.
I'm a super nerd, he breathed,
with actual reference. Then, he pulled the hood up. It couldn't conceal the fact that his features weren't quite human, but it blunted the effect enough that if we didn't stop for burgers, we'd be fine. You are super nerd, I agreed warmly, and pushed the door open. There's the car. Got it, he said, and took off running. Sam's speed wasn't as much of a factor on flat ground. He was a leaper, not a sprinter. But it was still impressive to watch him running full tilt towards Celia's waiting car. I followed, pausing only long enough to be sure that the door was latched and wasn't going to swing open again as soon as we were gone. The last thing I wanted to add to today's pile of troubles was a reprimand for leaving one of the exits open. Then I turned, and I ran. Sam reached the car at least 15 feet ahead of me, grabbing the back door and throwing himself bodily inside. I put on a little extra speed, slowing only when I reached the car. I slammed the back door before opening the front and sliding myself into the seat next to Celia. Sam was a fabric-swaddled lump in the back, the hood pulled down until it covered his face completely. Celia was looking at him with curiosity and not asking. The sound of her not asking was almost loud enough to fill the car.
Okay, I said. We're clear. Sam, this is Celia, the friend I told you about. Celia, this is Sam, my boyfriend.
You finally got a boyfriend? Damn. Celia's tone was light, but her face remained worried. Elmira's going to owe me so much money when we get home.
Miracles happen. Sam, it's okay to pull the hood back a little. I promise Celia won't freak, and I don't want you to suffocate.
I got the air conditioning fixed yesterday on a hunch, but this is still Florida, said Celia.
Okay,
said Sam warily, and pulled the hood back, enough to show Celia the shape of his features, the furry streaks along his cheekbones. Celia gasped. Sam had time to look hurt, and I had time to question the wisdom of being in this car, before she shook her head, putting her hands up, palms outward, one toward me and one toward him.
So you're a fury. That's fine. Good for you. And Annie, good for you too. You've had a boyfriend with bones that are really hard to break.
I'm babbling, sorry, I just...
What happened to you?
Not sure what you're talking about. Not sure I want to sit here while you explain it to me, said Sam darkly.
It's not the fury thing, I swear, protested Celia. It's your luck.
What about his luck? I asked. Something in my voice must have told Celia that she was treading on thin ice. She looked at me and shook her head.
It's gone, she said. His luck is gone.
Chapter 17. The thing to remember about allies is that they want you to be an ally right back. If you're not a friend to your friends, you're going to be an enemy eventually. Alice Healy. Lakeland, Florida. At the warehouse home of the Lakeland Ladies. We arrived at the warehouse to find the Lakeland Ladies in the middle of practice, circling the track with a familiar rattle of wheels, an exchange of breathless, amiable insults. Walking into that wall of sound was like a short, sharp slap. For a moment, only a moment, I was back in Portland, watching my own team get ready for a bout, and all I needed to do was strap on my skates and the world would start making sense again. The moment passed. The skaters were strangers. The team banners on the wall were unfamiliar, local logos and local colors and nothing that belonged to me. Most importantly of all, Sam was holding my hand, fingers so tight that my own fingers throbbed a little from the lack of circulation. I didn't pull away or ask him to lighten up. He was scared, confused, and in the company of a woman he didn't know, Celia, who was leading us across the warehouse toward the stairs. If he needed to squeeze my hand a little too tight to get through this, I was going to let him. A few of the skaters noticed us and waved. Celia waved back.
Just passing through, she called. Need to deal with some personal shit.
Did you bring us fresh meat?
Asked one of the derby girls. She was looking at me assessingly, studying me with an expression that bordered on avarice.
She ever skate before?
Yes, she skates, and no, she's not here to try out, said Celia.
She didn't slow down, and so Sam and I didn't either. We needed to get out of this open, human-filled space before his lack of luck caused his cloak to snag on something and get pulled aside.
She's an old friend, and we gotta go.
Aw, chorused a couple of the derby girls.
Come back soon, fresh meat, called another.
Why do they keep calling you that? Whispered Sam. He sounded half freaked out and half annoyed, which was sort of endearing. It had been a long time since anyone had wanted to defend my honor. That's what new derby girls are always called, I said. I haven't been fresh meat for years. I'm old and tough and sort of spoiled now. Best description of you I've ever heard, said Celia. We climbed the stairs to her small apartment, which was standing unlocked. I gave her a curious look. She shrugged. I leave it open during practice. I know none of the girls would steal anything. I don't have anything worth stealing except for my laptop. And if that went missing, the team captains would move heaven, earth, and purgatory to get it back. And this way they have access to my shower if they need it. That's always been the policy with the overhead apartments, which is part of why they try to only rent a derby family. No one wants to lose access to a hot shower. All that made sense to me. Right, I said. From the look on Sam's face, none of it made sense to him. He was smart enough not to argue. Under the circumstances, we didn't have that luxury. Celia's apartment was small enough to be compact, cozy, or cramped, depending on living preferences. The living room was about the size of my bedroom back home, with doors leading off it to the kitchen and even smaller bedroom. Everything was decorated in early thrift store, with a comfortable-looking, overstuffed couch given pride of place in front of the ancient television. It reminded me, in its piecemeal way, of home.
Bathroom's through there, said Celia, indicating the bedroom door.
She closed the door, thumbed the deadbolt, and turned to Sam. All right, drop the cloak. Let me get a look at you. Sam shot me an uncertain glance. I nodded, trying to project encouraging vibes, and he unfastened the cloak, letting it fall from his shoulders. Celia frowned, scanning him up and down before looking him dead in the eyes and saying, My name is Celia Mackey. I am a jink, which means I am as inhuman as you are, just slightly better at hiding it. I won't say you can trust me, because I don't know you well enough to make that kind of promise. I will tell you that Annie trusts me, and you wouldn't be standing here with her if she didn't believe I could help. Will you let me try to help?
Sure, said Sam uncomfortably.
I didn't say anything. Celia was right that we wouldn't have been here if I hadn't trusted her. Although being trapped in Lowryland with no car and a boyfriend who had suddenly lost the ability to change shapes had made my definition of trust a lot more flexible. Celia was non-human and could drive. Right now, that made her the most trustworthy person I knew. Celia stepped toward Sam, reaching toward him like she was approaching a skittish animal. At the last moment, before she would have actually pressed her hand against his chest, she stopped reaching and swept her fingers downward, through the air a bare inch or so from his skin. She stepped back again, frowning, and stuck her index and middle fingers in her mouth.
This is weird, said Sam.
Life is weird, I said.
It's gone, said Celia, around her fingers.
She pulled them out of her mouth, scowling, and said,
Your luck is gone. That's what you said in the car, said Sam. You didn't explain what it meant then, and you're not explaining what it means now.
I mean, oh, hell. Celia scowled for a moment before she said,
Neither of you is a jinx, so neither of you can see luck. That means there's going to be a certain amount of take my word for it in what I'm about to say. Can you do that for me?
We can try, I said.
Okay. Well, this sort of thing goes better when you have something to do with your hands. Follow me.
She turned and walked into the kitchen, where a card table was shoved up against the wall. There were three folding chairs already waiting there. Had this been anyone but Celia, I might have thought she'd planned our visit. As it was, I knew that she'd just gotten lucky. I settled with my back to the wall. Sam sat in the chair on the long edge of the table. After a moment, he scooted it around so that he was next to me, both of us crammed into a space that was barely big enough for one. I patted his knee reassuringly, and he responded by wrapping his tail around my ankle, holding me in place, keeping me where he was. I made no attempt to pull away. Celia went to the fridge and returned with a Tupperware pitcher filled with distressingly pink liquid and three matching glasses.
Hibiscus lemonade, she said, putting the glasses down and filling them. Drink. The sugar will help. Can I get that in writing to show my grandmother? Sam asked,
taking one of the glasses.
She likes to say that having a grandson who can literally climb on the ceiling justifies keeping the sugar levels low in our house.
The sugar will help you regenerate your luck, Celia said. I can't speak to hyperactivity.
Oh.
I took one of the glasses. The lemonade was toothachingly sweet, but tasty all the same.
What do you mean the sugar will help regenerate his luck?
All right. Celia sat.
This is where we get into things that you're gonna have to take my word for, because you literally don't have the senses to understand them.
Huh? Said Sam. Jinx and Mara, their cousins, have an extra organ in their brains, I said. It's sort of like the electroreceptor organs you find in sharks. It lets them see things that are invisible to the rest of us.
Like luck?
Asked Sam dubiously.
That doesn't sound like a real thing.
If everything that didn't sound real would have the decency to stop existing, the world would be reduced to what could be reasonably detected by a jellyfish, and I wouldn't need to pay my water bill, said Celia.
Jinx, see luck. It's everywhere on everything. It accretes like dust, sticking to whatever it touches until it rubs off or gets used up or blows away. Luck isn't a thing you earn. It's a thing you have.
Isn't that distracting?
Asked Sam. Is color vision distracting? Because there are people who don't have that, and they probably think the rest of us are weird the way we run around seeing red and green all the time. How about depth perception? Or any of the other things that vision can do? I was born seeing the luck, and so it's normal to me. If you took it away, that would become distracting. Celia laughed uncomfortably.
Right now, you're distracting. Looking at you is like looking at a hole. There's no good, there's no bad, there's no nothing.
How does that happen? I asked.
Before you can go into that, you need to understand a little more about how luck works, said Celia. Like I said, it sticks to you. Like attracts like attracts luck. So someone whose innate luck is mostly good will get more good luck, and someone whose innate luck is mostly bad will get more bad luck. It isn't fair, but there it is. Babies are born with a thin sheen of their mother's luck on them. In jink communities, it's customary to visit an expectant mother every day and take away any bad luck that's managed to stick to her so the baby can have the best seed luck possible. It doesn't always work. If the community's overall luck has turned bad, best they can do is try to minimize the damage.
Where does luck go?
Asked Sam.
You spend it, says Celia. Everyone does. It's a little more intentional for Jinx because we know what we're doing, but everyone does it. Say you're running late for the bus, and you know you should be late, but you're hoping so hard that something will have slowed the bus down just a few seconds so that you can catch it before it pulls away. If you have enough good luck banked up, it may burn off, and there's your bus. Lucky you.
So why isn't everyone winning the lottery every day?
Asked Sam. I liked this. He was asking questions. He was involved. Better yet, I, as the sole human at this table, wasn't the one asking things that could be viewed as potentially invasive. Being a cryptozoologist is like being a zoologist crossed with an anthropologist, and knowing that there's always a chance your subjects will get offended and kick you out for something that seemed like it should have been perfectly innocuous. Nothing is perfectly innocuous once a multi-century genocide gets involved. Nor should it be. Because when you burn good luck, the amount of good luck you have goes down, which makes it more likely that bad luck will come to fill the gap, and because people who aren't jinxed burn luck without meaning to, said Celia. If you followed me for a week, you'd think I wasn't a very lucky person. I don't get the good parking or find the mislabeled pack of top sirloin in the discount bin. I don't score amazing dresses and just my size on the clearance rack. The little lucks that haunt normal life don't haunt mine, because I don't choose them. I save what I have, and I use it when I know that I have enough good luck to cover what I want and keep me from turning into a bad luck magnet.
Huh, said Sam. Okay, I think I followed that. You only spend a dollar when you know you have five more.
Basically, said Celia. Actually, that's a great way of looking at it. Most people don't know how much money they have in their pockets.
If they find a dollar, they spend it. Jinx know how much we've got. We can make good choices about when to save and when to spend. And sometimes we spend even knowing it's going to get us hurt. Sometimes we say, I have a lot of good luck. I'm going to spend it all at once. I'm going to break the world. This time, I didn't say anything because I knew all too well what she was talking about. My family picks up allies and claims them as relatives, in part because there are so few of us, and in part because making someone an honorary aunt or uncle marks them as ours, as protected to the rest of the world. My Uncle Al in Las Vegas is like that. He's originally from a Jink community that got hit by a Covenant purge. The adults spent every scrap of good luck they had managed to save over the course of their lifetimes in the cause of getting the kids out of there safely. All the kids got away. All the kids found new homes, new lives, and a second chance. All the adults died. There was too much bad luck, too much backlash, and not a single one of them was able to get lucky enough to run. One of the reasons people don't always like Jinx, no matter how hard we try to be good neighbors, is because we can see luck, which means we can move it. Say I looked at Annie and thought, wow, she has so much good luck, she doesn't need all of that. And I thought I could make better choices with her luck than she could. I could take it. Celia shrugged. If I were being kind, I could take a little bit. And luck isn't only dollars, it's pennies too. If I steal a penny from every person I see over the course of a day, I'll wind up with plenty, and none of them will notice a difference. An ethical jink will never damage the community around them. What about an unethical one? Asked Sam. An unethical jink could rip away every scrap of good luck you have and leave you with nothing but bad, said Celia. Like attracts like, which means more bad luck would come, and you'd probably catch that bus you were running for when it ran you over. So, are you saying an unethical jinx stole Sam's luck? I asked. I wish I were, said Celia. We could deal with that. Look, if I took your good luck, I'd leave the bad behind and vice versa. If I tried to take both at the same time, it would be more than I could hold. I'd start bleeding back onto you. It is impossible for a jink to take all your luck, good and bad, at the same time. And even if a team decided to play some sort of fucked up luck con on you, there'd be dust on you by the time they were gone. Luck is a natural force of the universe, like gravity. It's everywhere. It's in the air. And you, my friend, have been scrubbed as clean as, I don't even know. As clean as something very, very clean. Okay. Hang on, I said carefully, while Sam was still gaping at her. Can we fix this? Because not having any luck sounds like a bad thing. It's not a bad thing, it's not a good thing. It's a perfectly neutral thing, which is why it's going to turn into a bad thing. Now both of us looked at her blankly. Celia sighed. Okay, say you open a door that has a 50-50 chance of triggering a booby trap. Good luck, it doesn't happen. Bad luck, it does. Well, Sam is currently a third variable. He opens the door. Nothing happens, not because he got lucky, but because the trap has somehow failed to register his presence, which sounds like good luck, sure, until someone with mostly bad luck comes into the building and all the traps go off at once. Or someone with mostly good luck comes into the building and the trap goes off with Sam between it and its potential target. He's not even an inanimate object right now. He's a null spot. Other people's luck is going to use that. My head hurts, complained Sam. How does this explain why I can't change back to looking human? I have no idea, but I'm betting it has something to do with your luck being gone, said Celia. Good luck would have shielded you from the negative effects of whatever you were exposed to. Bad luck would have made you shift back to your normal form at the worst possible time. The fact that you were able to get out of Lowryland without an angry mob in pursuit tells me that it's not a matter of the second. I changed to keep a couple of kids from getting hurt, and then I realized I was stuck, said Sam slowly. I don't know that anyone saw me. Neutral situation, said Celia. Okay, I said. So why is this a bad thing? Because we don't know why it happened, for one, said Celia. Because it's not natural. Everyone is luck, like everyone is gravity. suddenly losing one of the basic concepts of the universe? Probably not a good thing. Most of all, because right now, he's clean, but luck collects on everything, and bad luck is more common as a free-floating element than good luck. People hoard good luck and do their best to let go of the bad. So, statistically, whatever luck he rebuilds from here is more likely to be the bad kind. If you hadn't come to see me, I'd say he would have been a total bad luck bear inside of the week. I stared at her. Sam recovered first.
So, how do we fix this?
Seed luck. I can spare a little. Annie... Celia squinted at me. She can spare a little less, maybe, but still she can spare some. It's the difference between a worm in her apple and no worm in her apple.
Which is the bad one?
Asked Sam. Celia shrugged. I don't judge. Anyway, if we give you some seed luck, you should be able to start rebuilding it on your own. Hell, you may wind up luckier than you started, since you'll be starting with mostly good luck. Sam blinked.
What do you mean, mostly?
No luck is pure. Okay, I said. I'm happy to give some luck to the cause of Sam not getting creamed by a bus. What I want to know is, why does not having luck stop him from shifting shape? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. We'll deal with that next. Celia licked her finger, leaned over the table, and wiped it on Sam's bare arm. He made a disgusted noise, recoiling, and she answered it with a sunny smile. Suck it up, Buttercup. That's some luck for you. Good luck, high-octane stuff. Enjoy.
Did it have to come with spit?
Sam demanded. Yes. Celia turned to me, licking her finger again. Give me your arm. Wrinkling my nose, I did as I was told. Soap, I said. Soap and hot water and ew. You people are such babies, said Celia, and swiped her finger down my arm. Or started to, anyway. Midway through the motion, she froze, eyes widening and face paling, until she looked like something out of an amateur theater company's haunted house. Celia? I asked warily. She made a pained whimpering noise. Right. That's the sort of thing that has never meant anything good. I yanked my arm back, breaking the connection between us. She slumped backward in her chair, breathing heavily through her nose. Celia? I asked again. You okay?
Fuck me, she said.
Her voice was huskier than it had been before, pitched so low in her throat that it was almost a rumble. She reached for her glass of lemonade, hands shaking so badly that she nearly knocked it over in the process of getting a grip on it. Sam and I watched in silence as she lifted the glass, took a deep drink, and closed her eyes, her breathing slowly returning to normal. After more than a minute had passed, she put her glass down and opened her eyes, looking at us gravely.
It's you, she said, jerking her chin toward me. You're the reason he can't shift back.
What? I asked, and
what?
Sam demanded, and neither of us moved, and I was so grateful for that that I could have cried. If he had jerked away from me, I would have understood the reasons. How could he not want to pull away if his current condition was my fault? How could he want to be anywhere near me? But I would never have been able to forget that it had happened. I would never be able to let it go.
Okay.
Celia moved her first two fingers to her temples, rubbing briskly.
Okay. Luck is not the only thing that exists and is invisible and intangible and moves around the world. You can't bottle gravity, okay?
Okay, I said numbly.
But if you do things right, if you set things up correctly, you can steal gravity, make it weaker in one spot because you've made it stronger somewhere else. It's like moving luck, only harder, because luck is free-floating while gravity is internally generated.
I don't think that's how physics works, I said. Celia shot me a wry look.
Yeah, well, I didn't get a degree from metaphor school, all right? I had the luck stuff prepared.
Tav and I wanted kids someday, and we knew I'd have to be able to explain it to them. This is uncharted ground for all of us. Sorry, I said.
Don't worry about it,
she said, with a quick shake of her head.
We're sticking with luck and gravity because I don't feel like dealing with anything else. If you take all of someone's luck, they're screwed. They won't make more. They'll have to walk around luck